Mr. Cheeseman, Reel 15.
I meant to ask you, Mr. Cheeseman, and haven't done so, of your comrades, the people that you were meeting amongst your, you know, your squads and so forth. Any that stand out in your mind?
Actually, not individuals, but not an individual, but I would say the general comrades, mates, and what have you in general. Now, when I left Bovington after my basic training, there were three of us came to the 5th Battalion, and the other two went to B and C Company, so I saw very little of them, and of course I was put into HQ Company, and therefore, to all intents and purposes, I was put into a situation where there was no one around me that I could say hello Jack and what have you and things like that, and so my impression of my there was, after the strictness of my upbringing in Bovington, it was one of comradeship, big brother as it were, in a rough sort of sense. Now, what I think I can sort of put that into a context by saying that when I first came there and surrendered to our own headquarters, with duty people, we call them, that they took me down to the dark tent, and there was no one around, of course, all our maneuvers except the line orderly, and there was the line of kits laid out. Not particularly neatly at all. Right, I'm rubbish, Sean. So I laid out my kit as if it was for kit inspection and what have you. And I was rather proud of it. Now, come about 5 o'clock, they started coming in and things like that. And it was no less a rank than a full corporal said, "What the hell's all this? How here? You don't want to do that sort of thing?" Well, I'm being brought here, but he wasn't a jury. But we don't want that sort of thing. You'll be putting ideas into the officers' minds by that. Oh, come on, what have you? And it was a sort of jocular admonishment, as it were. And of course, naturally, too straight on his arm, I, by ordinary habits, started standing for attention, we don't do that here, sort of thing. Oh, and that, I think, will tell you. At the same time, that same corporal, later on, when I was doing something stupid, he was a corporal, all right. He knew how to act. So that was the sort of thing. And indeed, looking at them now, without exception, those lads were, what's the term, when you try to model yourself onto a person,
a role model.
They were all role models, and indeed I found that I was the ignorant one in everything. They were all above me, what have you, and they didn't show it. Having come from Bovington, where a chap that had joined the army a week before you, he was Lord and all, you should get some service in, I'm the author. There was very little of that at all. Of course, there was a few leg pullings and what have you. But
bullying didn't come into it at that time.
I cannot remember. I'll include my training as well, everyone. I cannot say I was ever bullied, not at all. What I think I've emphasized this before, but I think you have to, I can't emphasize enough. We had a higher class of person there that they wouldn't lower their dignity, you know, that sort of thing. And, well, they helped. They didn't offer. You had to ask. But once you asked, they would help you. And, but in a soldier, some sort of way, nothing posh, anything like that. Come on, yes, and a whacking great long string of horses, come on, anything like that. But it was, there was no, nothing, you know, horrible about it. Actually, I'm jumping ahead here a little bit, but when I eventually got to the permanent barracks at Perham Down, and I was in this barrack room, we actually had a puff in there. And he certainly got his lip pulled. But by jingles, let anybody take the mickey out of him, and we were shoulder to shoulder with him. That's the situation. And I think I did mention that we also had a vicar's son who prayed, knelt down beside his bed each night and prayed, and he was respected for it. They were better educated than I was, and I looked in rather in awe of them.
So the public image of the uncouth soldier, it wasn't accurate at all?
It was not at all. As a matter of fact, when I went to the battalion, you understand that those days that you had to be have 12 months service in before you're allowed to go outside in civilian clothes. Well, I got to my battalion on manoeuvres, and I was a few weeks short of it. But I was advised by NCOs, get yourself civvies, the battalion tailor, civilian trading as it were, came on manoeuvres with it, and he advised me, and my first civilian outfit, I've always remembered, was Scottish tweed. What do you call it again?
I think we've actually got this already. I think we've got this in the tape.
You know, and some cravat, cuffs with cufflinks. You know, we wouldn't have looked out of place in the poshest area of the West End. We'd be country cousins, of course, we're living there. And this is what I got a hold of. And by the way, here's the attitude. I was talking to the technical officer. He became my father, really. And I said, I've got my suit, and I'm going on leave, a maneuver break, fortnight, middle of the summer. And we are going on leave, and I will not get my 12 months in until halfway through my leave. So what do you mean? I said, well, as regards wearing civvies, yes, you leave camp in civvies, lad, you've had enough. So that, from an officer to a recruit, that was the attitude. Nevertheless, of course, discipline was there. I like to think of the Royal Tank Corps discipline as being discipline in its best sense and not BS in its worst sense. You know. But I think before we go any further, I ought to have a word about the cooking arrangements on manoeuvres. It was a standing job. By the way, there was such a thing as a catering corps those days and what have you, and all that sort of thing, but we never had, when we left Bollington, we never had anyone from any other unit, i.e. when you joined the Royal Tank Corps, when you went to unit, they would say, what are you, are you okay cooking? Right, we'll send you to cook and you'll become a cook. You could become a butcher. Do you know, we actually had, on the strength as well, a groom for the officers' horses, you know. So So it's quite normal for me to say, right, you are, this chap's gone on a cook's course, and it was a standing joke. That when he went on a cook's course, one of the things he learned was bricklaying. For roast beef, this is on the news, it needs to be roasted, and it needs an oven for roasting it. Well, when the camp was would be established, each unit would have its own dining room, of course, dining arrangements. A sheet of, say, 8 mile steel made into a small misnot, right, with metal ends and with a metal floor. The metal plate would be just outside the covering of the again. This tiny little Nissen hut, as it were, what would it be? 3 foot from side to side and probably 4 foot long. That would be put on, one end would be put on, then bricks would be put on the outside, and it was finished off with a whole lot of wet clay. And what they would do, of course, is get the crack of dawn, the whole lot of wood, light a fire in there until it got to a certain temperature. And when it got to a certain temperature, it would be about 10 o'clock or something like that in the morning, they would rake out all the remains of the fire and put tins of meat in there. And the other end of that little Nissen hut thing would be put on and sealed up with clay, and left in there for a certain and come 12:30 and brought it out, and it was beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, you know. So the cook had to learn how to bricklay. Can you imagine the state he got in? But not only that, how did they boil the water? Now, I've been trying to think of the name of it, and I'm not sure whether this is the right name or not, but they had these you know, in these old-fashioned Western, American Western stories, you go into a hut and they've got a metal stove in the centre. It's usually pot-bellied, but the English type is straight up and down. Well, if you can imagine that, but a rather large diameter, we'll say 2.5 feet, and then an iron basin put in the top, and then a fire put underneath, and it was called, I'm sure it was a Sawyer stove, which first came into service in the Crimean War, and here we were approaching the middle of the 20th century still using the same effect. But what about other cooking and things like that? Well, we had these petrol cookers, so, and all I can imagine is, can describe is, I don't know if you've ever bought a small bottle of liquid petroleum gas for camping. Well, they're only, 6 inches diameter, about 6 inches. Well, if you magnify that up so that you've got a foot diameter and 18 inches tall, enough, in fact, to contain 3 gallons of petrol, and the vaporizer. You've seen the vaporizer type on these hot air balloons, haven't you? Well, it's not sticking right; it's put in the bottom, sticking out the bottom of this canister, and you lighting it was it was a question like the blue paper and retreat. Because they would pressurise it with a foot pump, and open up, get quite a bit of petrol, chill out, and throw a lighted match in, woof. Then as it cooled down, as it were, the flames came down. It was heating these coils, and you would get a flame roaring out. Oh, what, 6 foot? I think there, and that would you could bridge your Dixies. And by the way, most of the Dixies were the old type of the First World War, and that was the cooking arrangements. They were a little bit better when we went to camp, but I'll mention that later.
Where did hygiene come into this?
It didn't. I never ever saw a cook wash his hands. There was no facilities. In fact, his dishcloth that he hung on his waist was absolutely free. You wouldn't even wipe the floor with them. But then we were tough in those days, I suppose. And the food was good. By today's standards, it probably wasn't a long way to be desired, but it was good. There were no complaints. But that was the cooking arrangement.
Did they put things in your tea?
They always said that. But by the way, I'm jumping the gun again. When I got to my permanent barracks, in the barrack room was two cooks. And we knew exactly what went in the tea, and there wasn't any of this bromide. No. Oh, that was a joke. Yeah. There was all sorts put in the tea. But,
you mentioned the fact that you'd gone on a recruiting drive in some time.
Right. Again, this was the technical officer. As I said, I became his blue-eyed boy. He recommended that. First of all. The 1st Tank Brigade, they were wanting recruits of the proper calibre. And so it was decided at the end of that 1936 manoeuvres, it was a fortnight before it finished, they would make up, it was a section of four medium tanks, a section of four light tanks, and of course the retinue, the cookhouse and lorry, the technical lorry, the bedding lorry, and what have you. And we were to go on recruiting organisation, which took us into the West Midlands. I was, I suppose, the technical officer was my name come to straight away because I got myself a pair of blue patrols, because that's what we wore. Tank people wore the then latest two-piece black suit, but when you were outside it was blue patrols. And the other thing was, remember that I was still a trained recruit. I wasn't a fully qualified soldier, and therefore my wages was 2 shillings a day. And they doubled our wages for this fortnight. It was absolutely gorgeous. And we spent nothing because we were given the freedom of the city. Our first port of call was Oxford. It's gradually moving away from Salisbury Plain. It was Swindon, Oxford, then various little places. And we got to Rugby. And we stayed the night there. We stayed the night at a couple of nights at Coventry, Birmingham, Wolverhampton, and then back down to Gloucester, and then back home again. It was absolutely good. And we were shown things that I've never ever seen. We left, for instance, we were taken around various factories in the Midlands, car factories, and seeing these wonderful machines all working automatic, as it were, you know. And a fire station, we were taken to fire stations, and of course, certainly at the civic, there was a civic reception for us. And I always remember one newspaper, it was in Birmingham, this, and they said we had 8 heavy visitors to the town hall today, and they went and described all the 12-ton medium tanks, and 13-ton medium tanks, and the 6-ton light tanks in there, and all this huge Armageddon sort of thing was preceded by a tiny little Austin 7, that was me. But it was quite an experience, and I really enjoyed it. By the way, it was an experience where, I have to tell you, that wherever we went and stopped, there was at least a dozen old First World War ex-servicemen that came up to me and said, you know, I drove the first tank. So that first tank that was driven into battle during the First World War had about, my reckon, about 460 drivers.
Did you travel by road on their own tracks?
Yes, yes. These, the medium tanks, I was trying to think of this here. The figure of 2,000 miles, I think, sticks in my mind. That is the mileage that they could do between complete stripped-down overhauls. You say, well, that's not very far, but when you consider the old land ships of the First World War, they had tracks that could last at the very much, right outside, 20 miles, and by the time they'd done 50 miles, they were worn out. So you see, the old medium tank with its 2,000 mile between overhauls was quite an advantage.
Did you stay at army camps on your way through?
No, as a matter of fact, when we, at Birmingham, we stayed in a drill hall, which was overlooking the Aston Villa football ground. So we had a grandstand view when we were playing. It would be actually drill halls, or if church halls and what have you, anywhere that could accommodate. Well, how many would there be? We say 4, 4, 16. So 32 tank people, and for administration, cooks and all that sort of thing, there would be probably in the region about 45 of us. So there's a place to, it wouldn't be 45 because there's about four officers there. They went to the hotels.
Did you get any recruits?
I don't know. I hadn't. It was just, here we are, this is what we did. We would do a few demonstrations on an open place. In fact, that was my first introduction, as it were, to the wireless technology. And that was, we had the Mark 6A light tank, which was fitted with the number 9 set. And the tank commander, well, the crews, three men and crew, were all battened down, and everything was blinded off. And there was an officer outside with his transmitter and hand microphone, saying, you know, driver straight ahead, driver straight ahead, and the tank commander would get this and relay it to his driver, driver straight ahead. Driver halt, driver turn left, and so on like that. And incidentally, he would, the chap that was guiding him would bring that tank slowly and as near as he could to the people that was watching before it stopped. And, you know, quite an impressive radio control tank, as it were. 1936s as well, and not just yesterday. What else did we? That's about it. It's faded right away. Nothing at all. I hadn't got into the habit of taking the camera with me at the time.
So you returned and your manoeuvres were over, and then we did talk about the course that you went on, the wireless course that we've got, which we have. But what happened after that? Where were you when? Where was the wireless course held?
Yes, when the battalion came back from manoeuvres and I came back from this recruit drive, we came to Perrindown Camp, which was halfway between the old First World War wooden huts and the very latest in military barrack structure. The manic quarters were still First World War, and I would say 90% of the barracks area was now, in fact, all the accommodation area was the modern stuff. The only First World War stuff was the tank hangars, and I think they're still there. They certainly were there after the war, because I had a look around at some of the tank hangars, one or two of the transport hangars, and that's about it, you know.
So these were modern, up-to-date buildings?
Modern, up-to-date buildings.
And what were they like?
If I could sort of describe one barrack block. You entered the barrack block building in the centre. And that centre portion was the ablutions. Then once you got into the building and through the ablutions, the toilets and what have you, and by the way, still just cold water, there was still no hot water, but once you got into the centre, you could turn left or right. You go right, you go into a barrack room, or before you go into the barrack room, there's a small passage with a small accommodation for NCOs in charge, sergeants and corporals, either side, small bunk places. Then you come into the barrack room properly, which had a central cenotaph, as we used to call it, with proper coal fires. There's no central heating. Very, very hard wood, highly polished floors, with the where the floor met the wall, curved upwards to, you know, there would be 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, 12, there'd be 14 beds in each barrack room. That's one side. You turned left, it was a mirror of that. Now, in front of you were stairs up. And upstairs you had exactly the same thing, ablutions in the centre, and so we had four barrack rooms in one block. And there were two blocks to a company. And there were four companies, so there was four blocks. And there were only, I don't know, I think in the region, so about three quarters filled, because we were under strength. Well, I'm just talking about recruiting driving there. And had it not been for the fact that the 1st Tank Brigade headquarters personnel, and of course all equipment, but the personnel. They came and they occupied two of those barrack rooms, Railway HQ. Now, we did have signals there, chaps from the signals. I think that's all we had, but other than that, then we were all tank corps. Shall I describe, before I get onto my...
Did you have a proper locker for your uniform things and these?
And underneath, hooks for your webbing equipment. And this seems ridiculous, but it's perfectly true. I blank-ored my equipment and polished its brasses when I got down there, hung it up in the proper way, and apart from the green, the webbing belt, which we use for guard mounting. Apart from that, they used to dust it down each. Leave it up, but just give the brasses a little bit of a touch of layer. And I never used it for a long time. You know. This, by the way, was a... This is where I say that we of the Royal Tank Corps were subjected to proper... ordinary type discipline, not the ridiculous bull, as it were. Each Saturday morning, those barracks rooms were inspected by the orderly officer. That was the only time when you left your lockers unlocked. You could leave them unlocked, by the way. An organ, and there would be a barrack room orderly on to watch it. Now, the officer would come in, and he did. It wasn't a question of, hello, that's not folded to the nearest eighth of an inch and what have you. What he looked for was cleanliness. If your kit was clean and folded the way, well, your wife would do it today, it's accepted. But let it be dirty and bad jingles, your feet didn't touch. That's the sort of thing.